We now come to the second and final debate of the afternoon, where we're going to look a little bit in particular at the risks, but also our own vulnerabilities to those risks, and address the question of how well are we doing. Again, I'm really delighted that a very, very good friend and a professional colleague whom I greatly admire, Tom Rees, very well known to many people here, the director of the Swedish Institute of International Affairs. I'm delighted that Tom has agreed to act as our last moderator of the day. I'm going to pass to him immediately to introduce again our very distinguished panel of eminent speakers. Afterwards, ladies and gentlemen, we'll have a very short break, really this time the out of your seat and stretch the legs, and then we will be able to have some brief concluding thoughts from the military side and then from our rapporteur, Christophe Bertrand. Tom, it's now your time, your microphone. Over to you. Many thanks.
Well, thanks a lot, Jamie, and thank you to all of you for being here. So we're starting our fourth session today, 1 hour. Topic, where are the risks? What are our strengths, vulnerabilities, and weaknesses? So it's a broad topic. It strikes me that it pulls together one of the themes that we've had here, contradictory themes today. There seems to be a tension between a desire for clarity from some and a feeling that we need to stay pretty general and broad from others. And there is a tension there. If we look at the previous session on human security and food security, I mean, there's a clear situation where we do need to clarify a little bit what NATO is about. Because there is a limit to how ambitious our goals can be in this world today. And that's one reason why we need to be clearer. It's absolutely correct, as we heard this morning that and this afternoon, that human security is a root of stability. We need indivisible security. We need a durable solution. But there's also a question, how much can we do? We're already trying in the Balkans and Afghanistan and have tried in Iraq in a big way, and our resources are overstretched in just three cases. And there are at least 20 other countries in the world which have even worse conditions. We have definite limits. To some extent, one could even argue, and some mentioned it this morning, that we're failing in Afghanistan. We're going to see that the jury is still out when it comes to Iraq. We're going to see how that works. And then we have the economic crunch that was also mentioned a lot this morning. All of this indicates that there is an overstretch in what NATO is trying to do. And so this is one area where we need to clarify. It's a technical issue, really. And a case in point would be Afghanistan. Is the objective in Afghanistan to build a state in our image? In other words, state building in our image. Or is it to plug a black hole and prevent terrorists from being able to operate from there? And the two things are very, very different. Trying to build a state in our image in Afghanistan is extraordinarily ambitious and probably doomed to fail. Trying to plug it as a black hole is something else which may be feasible at lower resources, lower cost. So I think that one of the things that the strategic concept will have to do is to clarify a little bit our operational objectives, tailor our ambitions to resources. But there's also a deeper level where we need to clarify, and that's partly what this afternoon's session is about. And that's the contentious issue, what is NATO actually for? What are the vital interests? What are the existential threats? As we heard this morning, and I think Professor Larry Friedman put that very clearly, I mean, there's dangers with clarity. It can artificially constrain Article 5. It can raise a can of political worms. It certainly reveals the diversity of members and their diversity of interests. And it also raises a diversity of challenges, which can simply become too overwhelming. But there's also a danger if we stay fuzzy. If indeed NATO is going to be defensive or reactive fireman, we also have to clear up what are the fires that we're going to try to put out. In other words, identify the threats. Because different threats require different capabilities. It would be extremely dangerous if we got locked into plans, as was pointing out. But the planning for different types of events is necessary. And for that, we do need to clarify a little bit what we're going to deal with. Is it counterinsurgency or is it force on force? Is it cyber attack or piracy, nuclear deterrence, theater missile defense? There's a whole range of issues that do need to be clarified better if NATO is going to be able to deal with them. And politically also there's a danger if we don't clarify what NATO is about, because it means every time a crisis emerges, you have to go into the same round of negotiations again to see who's willing to take part. So we risk having coalitions of willing at each crisis. But there is a problem with this, and the problem is that NATO is now so big and has so many diverse interests among its members that if we start to clarify too much, we risk cracking up the alliance. Nevertheless, I think that the next strategic concept is going to have to try and square this circle. And one of the reasons is also to get our populations and our politicians on board, because mutual help, which is one of the fuzzy definitions of NATO, is that we're just going to be mutually help each other, is not enough, because help implies sacrifice. And sacrifice means that you have to have a will to suffer. And will to suffer means you have to have identify that you have a strong enough interest yourself in order to commit to that. And interest, again, then means clarity about interests and threats. So I think that we're going to have to be clearer about this, even if there is a definite cost to it. But this is the dilemma, I think, of the next strategic concept. This is a little bit what we'll look at this afternoon. We have three speakers: Professor Louise Richardson, Principal and Vice Chancellor, University of St. Andrews, and a long background in terrorism; Mr. Jan Kopernicki, Vice President of Shipping, Shell International Trading and Shipping Company Limited; and finally, General Henri Bonteja, Chairman of the Military Committee of the European Union. You each have 10 minutes, starting now. And please, Mr. Jan, Professor Richardson, would you please start? Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Briefly, I would simply say, reiterate the point one of the panelists made earlier, that the Milkman in Omaha, about whom we've been hearing a great deal today, is primarily concerned about whether he is safe going to the shopping mall or the Londoner about getting on a bus or the underground. So if NATO wants to secure popular support, I think it is going to have to address issues like terrorism. So let me speak from the perspective of somebody who's thought about terrorism and confine my comments to that. Briefly, I'll address two subjects, two questions. Where are we in the campaign against terrorism? Secondly, will the structures we have in place serve us going forward? And finally, I'll provide a very brief list of where I think the risks and vulnerabilities and so on are. So simply put, terrorism is a tactic, and it will continue to be deployed as long as it proves to be effective. But when we think about the aims of terrorists, I think it's important to differentiate between their long-term and short-term objectives. Their long-term objectives are the kind of political and territorial claims with which we're long familiar, some fairly narrowly defined, like independence, secession, and so on, others much more transformational, like establishing a caliphate, overthrowing capitalism, and so on. Terrorists have been singularly unsuccessful in achieving these political changes they're trying to effect. On the other hand, if you consider their immediate motives, you find that these are issues like a desire for revenge, a desire for glory, a desire to provoke a reaction. And I think the tactic of terrorism has been spectacularly successful in achieving these objectives, especially in the almost 8 years since 9/11. So given that, I think we have to face the fact that we're likely to see a continuation of this tactic. I believe that the declaration of the war on terrorism, and indeed the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, whatever the arguments to be made in their favor, have played directly into the hands of terrorists, in that they have provided both issues to be avenged, such as the heavy civilian casualties, or indeed the treatment of prisoners, as a result of the conduct of war. So when the most powerful countries in the world, and indeed the most powerful military alliance in the world, unite to declare war on what is, after all, a motley collection of extremists, I believe we're elevating the stature of those extremists. We're providing them the glory that they seek, largely in an effort to redress the humiliation they perceive themselves to have suffered at our hands. And we are demonstrating, in essence, their importance, which the only way they can acquire importance is in the scale of our reaction to them. So I believe that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have served as recruitment agencies and training grounds for terrorists, ensuring that the ones we face in the future would be more battle-hardened and better trained than the ones we face today. I say this not to make a case against the war in Afghanistan, but only to argue for an appreciation of the cost of that war. And one of the costs being, I think, a likely continuation of the tactic of terrorism and the fact that we will face a better trained cohort of terrorists. A couple of brief points here that I think need to be made is that in their statements, strategists for the terrorist groups we face, groups like Al-Qaeda, are very, very clear that they do not draw distinctions amongst us. Don't draw distinctions between NATO, Britain, the US, France, and so on, or indeed even aid agencies. They see us all as one and the same. I think it's worth bearing in mind that while we have a tendency to be acutely aware of the differences of opinion on our own side, we tend to assume that our adversary is a unitary actor, that they are united with one view of the world. Well, they tend to do the very same. They tend to be unaware of the differences between us and assume that we're a unitary actor. It seems to me that if we see them as an undifferentiated enemy, we are likely in the future to make the same mistakes we've made in the past, which is to conflate the threats we face. I think they justify their actions against us on the grounds that they are justified in killing as many of us as we kill of them. For us, read simply the West, or for them, read simply Muslim. The longer our military campaigns go on, the more casualties there will be, and the more of us they will believe themselves to be justified in killing. Another unrelated development, though it speaks to some of the points raised earlier. Mohammed Al-Bardawi spoke very movingly, and indeed the last panel we heard very movingly about poverty. It has to be said, however, that the link between poverty and terrorism has not been demonstrated. There is no doubt that poverty is a risk factor for terrorism. It increases the likelihood that a terrorist group will form and that once formed it will garner adherence. But a straight line between poverty and terrorism has simply not been demonstrated. What has been demonstrated, however, is something that I think we really do have to worry about, which is the most combustible possible combination is a large cohort of young men with reasonably high degrees of education in an economy which is not able to absorb them. We've seen this time and time again in different terrorist groups, where you have a situation with heightened expectations and an economy unable to absorb them, leading to young men with time on their hands being disaffected. One of the results of the economic crisis we all face is that this development is going to grow both within NATO member countries and beyond. So where are we in the campaign against terrorism? I would say that we are in the thick and an economy unable to absorb them, leading to young men with time on their hands being disaffected. One of the results of the economic crisis we all face is that this development is going to grow both within NATO member countries and beyond. So where are we in the campaign against terrorism? I would say that we are in the thick of it. As to our structures and whether the world has changed since 9/11, whether you believe, as many do, that 9/11 changed the world, or whether you believe, as I do, that it was the American reaction, or, as I would argue, overreaction to 9/11 that changed the world, I think it's clear, or I would argue, the security environment has indeed changed since the last NATO strategic concept. 9/11 had the effect of exploding the myth of American invulnerability. It was readily apparent that neither America's weak and friendly neighbors nor her vast oceans any longer sufficed to ensure American security. Just as in the post-war period, America sought to avoid conflict with the USSR, but preferred that if there were to be a conflict, that it be conducted far from American shores, indeed in Europe. In the post-9/11 world, America still prefers to fight its antagonists overseas, as indeed would any country in the same position. But I think the notion that in fighting terrorists in Afghanistan means that we won't be fighting them at home hardly needs to be argued on the anniversary of the London bombings. We've mentioned the question of deterrence, which indeed has been the cornerstone of NATO's mission of collective security. Deterrence can, I believe, still serve to prevent a state handing weapons of mass destruction over to a terrorist group. I believe that deterrence has always worked here, and indeed the fears of proliferation from rogue state to sponsored terrorist group I believe, has always been exaggerated. But terrorism does not work against a group that does not control a territory, whose members are happy to die for the cause and willing to cause the deaths of the communities they claim to represent. The years since 9/11 have demonstrated the fact that the most casual examination of counterterrorism campaigns in the years prior to 9/11 would have revealed, namely, that the military is too blunt an instrument to be relied upon exclusively to defeat terrorism, short of the massive human rights violations that would eliminate the distinction between the terrorist and the counterterrorist. And I would say that almost invariably the military seem to be the first to point this out. Terrorists are invariably significantly weaker than their enemies, otherwise they would not resort to terrorism. Therefore, military strength rarely translates into military victory against terrorism. This is ultimately a political and even a psychological conflict and must be fought, and I think can only be won in these terms. So to counter the very real security threat from terrorism, I think NATO must engage in an integrated, multifaceted campaign that combines coercive measures against the perpetrators of violence with conciliatory measures towards the communities in which these groups recruit. There's simply no substitute for good intelligence in countering terrorism. What we need above all is an intelligence alliance, almost more than a military alliance. When faced with a transnational adversary, the intelligence must be transnational too. The West in general, and NATO as its security provider, must also construct a narrative to counter the narrative of its adversaries. This is a long way from preventing Soviet tanks from crossing the plains of Bavaria, but I think NATO must be able to adapt if it is to remain relevant and to justify the expenditures that ever-increasingly strapped governments will increasingly question. So very briefly, I think the risks are, first, that Afghanistan will prove a graveyard for NATO's soldiers, as it has proved for foreign soldiers in the past, and that it will lead to a more highly trained and larger terrorist cohort. That a very grave risk is that Pakistan will implode, and indeed the nightmare scenario of being lose control over its nuclear weapons. And the third risk is that the public will tire of foreign intervention because of the complexity and costs involved. The strengths of NATO are well known: military strength, democratic governments, a popular ideology which is popular the world over. The vulnerability, as one alluded to earlier, the inadequate control of nuclear material. But a second vulnerability that I think we have to take very seriously and has been ignored thus far today is the tendency of governments to overreact. François Eisberg said earlier today that we do not know what the next terrorist attack will be like. That's true, we don't. But we do know what the pressures on democratic governments in the wake of a terrorist attack will be. There will be pressure for a strong, usually military reaction, and that rarely works. The weaknesses are simply that NATO is not as strong as exercising soft power as it is in exercising hard power, and we will need to exercise soft power to prevent a future terrorist attack. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Also remind everyone, please, to send me up your questions. That was a very gloomy note there. Afghanistan generates and trains terrorists. Pakistan implodes and our public tires. And we're waiting for the next unexpected attack. But this may well be realistic. From a threat, and this is just one sort of threat, we now turn to vulnerabilities. For that, Jan Kopernicki will be speaking. Thanks.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you to NATO and to you all for the invitation to come and speak here. I work for a little oil company. In my day job, I run boats. I've come here today to talk a little bit about energy and to suggest that scenaric thinking in scenarios, may assist the current concept debate. And at the end, I just want to maybe suggest a few what I'd call big rules for how that engagement might proceed. Because as I listen to the really vital and quite exciting at times conversation today, it seems that the agenda is very, very large, the time short, and the imperatives high. And somewhere there has to be a cutting down to the key focus objectives. And that, I think, is an exciting challenge for the organisation. Self-evident that energy is important. It's important for a number of reasons, not least economic and political. The economic ones are very evident as we see the effect of oil prices on economic activity. But the political element, I'd argue, is as or more important. And without venturing into the discussion of the future availability of water, energy is not dissimilar in the sense of being a key element in most governments' thinking. In our little oil company at Shell, we talk about three hard truths, though, about energy. First thing is that demand is going up. It's going up quite quickly. And although there's a quite necessary fascination with renewable sources of energy, and that's entirely justified, there's an absolute shortage, even if you do everything in the renewable locker that you can think of. The second hard truth is that the simple-to-find, easy oil and gas is going to be fairly short in supply in the coming decades. And that has imperatives because the oil and gas that we're now finding is in hard-to-get-to places, typically in the middle of oceans or, in European terms, under ice to the north. And this suggests that if you think in your military planning, you might have an eye to whether you have an interest in those areas of water. And being a boat person, you'll not be surprised that my agenda this afternoon is about the importance of the water dimension, because I think that is underweighted in the conversation compared to the projection of force on land, which I know is a topical subject at military academies today. The third hard truth is that as society, we have to act together to resolve these problems. And at earlier NATO events, and I've been fortunate enough to be invited, not least to your wonderful school at Oberammergau, which I would recommend to all members here who have not visited the establishment, not least for its training success. But we will need to act together to find resolution. And NATO, in its way, forms a glue amongst countries and society in a way that doesn't quite fit lots of other things, but in today's society is a potentially extremely valuable tool as we move forward. Very briefly on energy, I'd propose five strands of solution, five pillars, if you will. Diversification's fairly obvious. Varying geographic sources, a second one, clearly also very important. There's been an allusion to the issue of gas pipelines in Europe. Again, a little piece of homework to be done about cross-connecting. But probably more important, the fourth pillar is actually creating entry points around Europe to bring particularly gas into Europe in case there's a shortage because somebody has driven a bright yellow JCB into a pipeline one afternoon and completely throttled the supply in one direction. Pipelines are remarkably vulnerable in practice, even for innocent events, like people backing trucks into them. Having entry points where you can feed your system redundantly from the water, and I would then argue that the water supply dimension is remarkably resilient, and it's also politically resilient, in that you can offer to supply in different places and thereby mitigate different threats at different times. And I think the fifth and final pillar is around investment in technology. Europe can be a leader in technology and needs to be in this conversation. A key fuel I'd mention is this liquefied natural gas. At the moment, only a small proportion of European marginal supply comes via LNG. This is gas that's liquefied down into a liquid by cooling. But it potentially could grow enormously as a reserve supply and in future will be a key supply. Indeed, at the moment, only 7% of total European demand is from natural gas. This will probably grow to about 15% in years to come. But it isn't just gas. If you look at Europe, it's a peninsula. Sort of forgotten that minor detail. And most everything, from toys for children to car parts, to cornflakes, comes by sea at some point. Yet the sea is invisible. It's invisible politically because there are no constituencies where people vote at sea. I think it's quite a practical dimension. But it is actually enormously invisible to the European community. And I wouldn't specify NATO in this conversation. I think the European community shares the interest in that. But certainly in the topic of energy, the military element of protecting flows of energy security, I would reason, is an entirely legitimate role for NATO to play. And yes, of course, we've had the successes recently with the response to piracy, and I, as a customer, on behalf of my seafarers on my ships, would like to thank NATO for the protection you have offered us at such short notice. You've done very well, but in a sense, the piracy issue detracts attention from the more strategic maritime threats which exist in a number of different places. And while piracy has given high visibility to the navies and to the maritime interests, it's almost too much in the sense that it's taken focus to one group in one place and distracted from the generality, which I would say in the medium term is very important. Turning then to the strategic concept paper and where you're going with that, an exciting development. In Shell, we've done this sort of thing because we have to plan for our little oil company. And from time to time, and I've worked in that planning division, we draw up scenarios. And people misunderstand these terribly. They think that they're forecasts of the future. In fact, they're not. They're intellectual gymnastics. In a case some years ago, we did a set of scenarios around the low oil price. And this is many years ago, you'll recognize. Indeed, a low oil price did eventuate. Because we'd done the scenarios, the managers in our company around the world had an appreciation of the mechanisms that came into play in a low oil price world. We hadn't forecast it correctly at all, but the issues were the same. And we reckoned that we gained, I don't know, 3, 6, 9 months of advantage in response because we'd been through the gymnastic. Now, our current scenarios are called Scramble and Blueprints. Scramble is a world, as you would expect, where people are running for cover to protect their own national interests. And we've got a bit of scramble going on at the moment. Blueprints is a more idealistic world where people cooperate with each other to find cooperative solutions. And we're seeing shards of that, for instance, in the forthcoming Copenhagen Carbon Dioxide Climate Summit at the end of the year, which is a very important event in the environmental calendar. Neither of them's a forecast, but they point to directions. And I think there's an opportunity in NATO's thinking to consider scenarios for NATO's threats and opportunities, not forecasts, but to exercise the thinking as we go forward with the concept paper. Now, I mentioned at the beginning the challenge of too many things, too little time, and the need to focus. So can I quite immodestly suggest a few big rules for the debate. First, to give equal weight to the sea as to the land. Secondly, to embrace consideration of asymmetry. Asymmetry in its widest sense. We've had allusions today about asymmetric warfare, the asymmetric threat from terrorists, the asymmetry of the organization, and the list goes on. But it's a remarkably symmetric organization at the moment, and one of the key transitions I'd suggest is from symmetry to asymmetry. To see the relationship with Russia as an opportunity, and that with the European community as a given. Penultimately, to consider the protection of energy flows as a vital interest. And finally, in a simple test of meetings and things that you have, that the external view should exceed the internal view. I think a very wise comment made today, the observation about how internal and how internally focused the conversations have been. It's a privilege to be here and join you, and we stand ready to support your strategic concept discussion. And again, we thank you enormously for helping our seafarers at sea. That's highly appreciated on a personal level. Thank you.
Thank you very much also. Interesting. Previous session, we had the appeal from the humanitarian organizations for closer interaction with NATO, and now we've had earlier this morning from Lord Levine and now from Jan Kopernici here appeal for or a suggestion for closer interaction with NATO when it comes to security and vulnerabilities. Third speaker, General Bontegia, Chairman of the Military Committee, European Union, and you have 10 minutes.
Thank you very much, Chairman. First of all, I would like to say how much I appreciate the spirit of openness prevailing at this seminar. My presence here at the invitation of the Secretary General, Monsieur de Hoopskepper, demonstrates the importance we all attach to enhance cooperation between the EU and NATO. Our debate today is about risks, strengths, and weaknesses. Obviously, I'm not entitled to assess NATO capabilities or fault lines. Thus, I will limit myself to some remarks on the 2008 report on implementation of the European Security Strategy, focusing on its description of security risks, and I will then add a few personal comments in French. The 2008 implementation report. The European Security Strategy was agreed by the Council in 2003. Starting from an analysis of the main threats to Europe's security, terrorism, proliferation of WMDs, regional conflicts, failing states, and organized crime, this document sets for the EU three objectives: conflict prevention, using a combination of civilian and military capabilities, building security in the European neighborhood, Balkans, Caucasus, and Middle East, promotion of effective multilateralism. The 2008 implementation report is not an update of this document, but coming 5 years after the ESS, it takes into account changes in the strategic environment. Under the heading of Global Challenges and Key Threats, it brings the issue of proliferation of WMDs to the fore, of course, North Korea, Iran, and a new worldwide interest in nuclear energy, with its associated risks, account for this new priority. Terrorism and organized crime are still mentioned as major concerns. Piracy, of course, being the latest avatar of transnational criminality. But the 2008 report emphasizes emerging risks: climate change, cyber warfare, and energy dependence. Later on, in the same document, the main strategic goal of the EU, building stability in Europe and beyond, includes, for the first time, Afghanistan in the geographical sphere of EU's major interests, which reveals at least some NATO-EU permeability. This brief and incomplete summary is a good indication of the European perception of the current risks for the security. Obviously, there is a wide consensus today on the risks and threats that could affect our Western societies. Significantly, there is no mention of a direct military threat in the 2008 report. But can we rule it out for the foreseeable future? There is no need at this stage to expand on this catalogue of risks. Most of them are transverse challenges reaching far beyond the military sphere. They call for global strategies, including various degrees of military involvement. From an EU point of view, these challenges can only be taken up through an effective multilateralism. Maintenant, quelques commentaires en français. D'abord, ces documents constituent-ils une référence pour l'OTAN? L'implementation report que je viens d'évoquer ne constitue pas, à l'évidence, un modèle pour le concept stratégique de l'OTAN. Les deux organisations ne sont pas de même nature, ont des objectifs et des missions qui diffèrent et ne partagent pas la même culture. Lorsqu'une crise émerge qui puisse affecter les intérêts des États membres, la réaction de l'Union européenne sera d'abord civile, diplomatique et économique, sans exclure une action militaire, mais ce ne sera pas nécessairement une priorité. Par contre, l'implementation report peut servir de référence à l'OTAN parce qu'il a été agréé en décembre 2008 par 21 des 28 alliés. Les risques et les menaces sont-ils les mêmes pour l'Union européenne et pour l'OTAN? Globalement, la réponse est oui. Les nations constitutives des deux entités ont en commun les mêmes valeurs, les mêmes forces européennes, les mêmes standards et les mêmes concepts militaires, ceux de l'OTAN. mais leurs intérêts peuvent parfois diverger sur des enjeux économiques ou si une menace affecte directement, plus spécifiquement, une partie de l'espace européen. Les capacités aussi sont différentes. L'UE ne peut s'appuyer sur la puissance globale des États-Unis. Elle n'a ni les structures, ni l'expérience de l'OTAN. Elle n'a pas la responsabilité de la défense militaire de l'espace européen et ne pourrait assumer la gestion d'une opération militaire lourde telle que celle conduite aujourd'hui par l'OTAN en Afghanistan. À l'évidence, elle ne serait pas armée pour affronter la résurgence d'une menace militaire majeure. Si le risque existe, il relève clairement de l'OTAN. Les vulnérabilités des deux organisations sont également dissemblables. L'OTAN est une alliance militaire très puissante qui bénéficie des moyens et du leadership américain. À l'Union européenne, la décision d'engager des moyens militaires est plus difficile à prendre, tant la méfiance est grande dans les opinions publiques, marquée par des siècles de guerres fratricides à l'égard de l'usage de la force. Mais la force de l'Union européenne, qui fait défaut à l'OTAN, est son exceptionnelle capacité à concevoir, planifier et conduire de manière intégrée, dès les prémices de la crise, la manœuvre d'ensemble civilo-militaire qui doit lui permettre de la prévenir ou de la gérer. L'Union européenne aujourd'hui, c'est une capacité militaire limitée, mais réelle, adossée à de puissantes capacités civiles. Pourtant, dans la gestion militaire des crises, nos deux organisations sont confrontées au même problème. D'abord, l'insuffisance des ressources disponibles pour les déploiements extérieurs. Ceci témoigne de l'insuffisance de la transformation de nos armées et pose la question de l'équilibre entre les moyens affectés à la sécurité directe des territoires nationaux et ceux destinés à l'action extérieure. Dans chacun de nos pays, cet équilibre dépend de la capacité des gouvernements à faire admettre au Parlement que les risques et les menaces doivent être affrontés aujourd'hui en priorité à l'extérieur de nos frontières. La deuxième difficulté, qui explique largement la première, naît du faible soutien des opinions publiques européennes à des opérations lointaines, risquées, coûteuses et dont l'efficacité paraît de moins en moins garantie. Le troisième problème majeur est celui de la faiblesse des dépenses de défense en Europe. Et ce phénomène dangereux est encore aggravé aujourd'hui par la crise économique. Enfin, au sein de l'Union européenne comme de l'OTAN, il est évident qu'il n'y a pas d'unanimité dans l'appréciation de l'importance relative des risques et des menaces. L'histoire et la géographie expliquent largement ces sensibilités différentes quand il s'agit de la politique russe ou des déchirements en Afrique, je pourrais même ajouter le terrorisme, mais l'absence d'unité réduit indiscutablement les capacités d'anticipation et d'action de nos deux organisations. Et en guise de conclusion provisoire, je voudrais simplement dire qu'il est évident pour tous que ni l'OTAN ni l'Union européenne ne peuvent affronter seuls les risques transverses que j'ai évoqués. Plus que jamais, le renforcement de la coopération entre nos deux entités est un enjeu majeur.
Merci beaucoup, mon général. And the first two questions are in fact directed to you, and the first one is Mr. Leo Michel.
Thank you. I'm Leo Michel from the Institute for National Strategic Studies in Washington. For General Bontéjà, your successor at CEMA, General Georges Lin, has referred to caveats as a, quote, poison for multinational operations, unquote. What should the new strategic concepts say to develop an antidote to this, quote, poison, unquote, which perhaps could affect ESDP as well? I know this is a sensitive question, but I thought someone should raise it.
We'll take one other question, and that is over here to our Portuguese colleague.
Okay, thanks. Nuno Rocher from the Euro-Atlantic Institute. First, one observation on what Professor Richardson said on terrorism. I think one dimension that maybe we don't talk so much is the revolutionary ideological nature of some of the struggle that has been stressed by people like Max Seligman or indeed like Bau Kutumi Rahman, but that idea that we should also be involved in the war of ideas, as you know, is now very much popular in the Obama administration, and maybe that's a topic that we could touch. Pour le général Bonchia, on a entendu parler des nécessités de sécurité alimentaire et peut-être de la participation de l'OTAN dans les opérations, peut-être aussi de l'Union européenne. Ce qu'on sait, c'est que depuis la fin de la guerre froide, les armées européennes se sont transformées dans des armées de double usage, dans l'équipement, dans la doctrine, avec les opérations d'appui à la paix, l'évacuation de non-combattants, etc. etc. Est-ce que vous voyez en limite pour cette transformation d'une armée purement militaire dans une armée de double usage?
We'll follow on with some more military-oriented questions. Harlan Ullman.
I'm Harlan Ullman. I have a question I'd like to put to the audience here and by extension to the Secretariat, to the NAC, and the Military Committee. Earlier today, I stressed the need for relevance in establishing the case for NATO beyond a theological or intuitive basis. Let me put a little bit more meat on that bone. I have been struck by a glaring omission. Nobody has mentioned the NATO Response Force, the NRF. And I wonder if that is by omission or whether the NRF has become a sort of mad relative to be locked in the attic and ignored, or whether the NRF has real relevance today. And I would hope it is the latter. And if it is the latter, it seems to me that the NRF needs to be put in a situation where it can be utilized, perhaps under ACT as an experimental force, or indeed under the command in Lisbon. But I think if we don't use it, we shall lose it. And so my point is, I'm just taken by the absence of discussion on the NRF, and I would hope it will play some role in the strategic concept design.
Moving on to that, on Article 5, Edgar Buckley.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Under the current treaty and the current strategic concept, there is, of course, no obligation for any ally to support a non-Article 5 crisis management operation in the North Atlantic Council, or indeed to contribute forces to one if one is voted upon by the North Atlantic Council and launched. Now, I want to focus on the political risk that this situation represents. Supposing there is, and I accept the idea of thinking in scenarios, what about a scenario where we have a crisis emerging in Europe, which is actually too big for the European Union to handle with an EU-led operation, and we recognise that the EU doesn't have limitless capabilities, but the US don't want to do it. And I think the risk that the US might not want to do it is a significant one, given their experience over the last few years with the contributions coming from Europe. So I think we need to face up to this in the strategic concept. Up until now, I've not been a great one for discussing a division of labour between these two organisations. But the possibility that we'll be faced with a crisis that Europe can't handle and the United States won't handle, I think it would be extremely damaging for NATO.
Sufficiently damaging to warrant a serious thought. One more on geopolitics, Trine Flockhart.
Yes, apologies that my question is not really to any of the three presenters, because it's yet another dog that hasn't barked this afternoon, which is the possible new role for nuclear weapons. Because although the issue of nuclear weapons has been raised on several occasions today, we haven't actually addressed how the role of nuclear weapons should be defined in the new strategic concept. And I think that is a crucially important issue that needs to be addressed. I'm well aware, as I'm sure most of you are, that NATO is not all that keen on being very precise about nuclear weapons. And one of my favourite quotes is when the 1968 strategic concept came up for discussion at the London summit, a diplomat stepped out and said, "The ambiguity must remain absolutely clear." Now, that, I think that must be the quote of all times, but I wonder whether that is still the case. As arms control and nuclear weapons get onto the agenda, I think it's time for NATO to start thinking about, in more precise terms, what is the role of nuclear weapons. And my question, I suppose, to be put on the agenda is, should we be more precise about nuclear weapons, or is it still a case of the ambiguity remaining absolutely clear?
Thanks. Covering the gaps that we don't have in the panel, and there are many, of course. Let's move over onto another topic, and that's terrorism. We have a first question here from Ambassador Nabila Al-Mul.
You, this is to Ambassador of Kuwait, and not a member of NATO, just ICI, and we're very happy to remain that way as partners, but to cooperate with NATO and other countries. My comment is on one of the risks that will be faced or has been faced by NATO and the rest of the world, and terrorism. I do disagree with you, Louise Richardson, that you said, you know, there is no direct link with perhaps poverty, but poverty is certainly one of the riding reasons for the terrorism. Add to that unemployment and failure to resolve certain issues. And the risk is there, what I'm saying is, for NATO, here you are trying to draw a concept for the 21st century, but you have inherited, we all have inherited as a world body, failures of the 20th century. There are problems that are yet to be resolved. And if we don't approach that, no strategic concept, no military prowess, no coordination can address that unless you look at the source. We are very happy to coordinate our work in the maritime rescue at Atalanta and others. You have three of the Gulf countries there, Saudi Arabia, Oman, and Emirates, cooperating with the International Pirate Group. But why do we have to be there in the first place? It's because we failed. We really failed to address Somalia's problem. And we're cooperating with the World Food Programme. It's because no one paid attention to Somalia. So we're coming at the end of the day to help to keep, as the representative of executive director of the World Food Programme, keep the food chain open. Yes, but does that solve the problem? No. We're going to have similar problems in the future. So my earnest wish is that we do need the help of the military, both land and sea. We do need NATO. NATO needs to coordinate with everyone, UN, Arab League, African Union. But we need also to address the basic problems in the African continent, in the Asian subcontinent, and in our area, the Palestinian problem. Thank you.
Thank you. More on terrorism. Fraser Cameron.
I think the ambassador made a good point there about the need for linked up policies, because with Somalia, it was obviously a contributory factor, the overfishing by some European trawlers that actually led to the piracy there. I wanted to really ask Louise, based on her personal experience, because you've been in the States for some time, as to whether there's a narrowing of the different approaches between the US and EU and terrorism. At the beginning, the US was talking about the war on terror, and the EU was talking about the fight against terror, different semantics. The US was emphasizing more the military, US more police and intelligence. Do you see now, after 8 years of both sides dealing with the terrorist threat, that there's a narrowing of differences?
And more on terror. Ambassador De Dardelle from Switzerland.
Yes, thank you. Professor Richardson, you mentioned something about to the effect that the military is too blunt an instrument to defeat terrorism. I believe you're quite right in saying that, but I'm led to think that to solve failed state problems and to develop a coherent exit strategy for the military, you usually, and in other scenarios too, you usually need to rely on national security forces, police forces, non-military security forces. And so this is my question. It's a genuine question. I don't really know the answer. Should the strategic concept include more on police components within NATO and within that security construct, or should NATO still go on relying on external police forces when need be? Thank you.
Thank you. We have 7 minutes left. I've been asked to break off a little bit early here, 10-2. So let me take two questions that are sort of directed towards Jan Kopernicki. First of all, Tomasz Walaczek.
Thank you, Thomas. It really isn't a question as much as a point for perhaps the rapporteur or the Secretary General's conclusions later on. First of all, on Tomasz Walaszczyk with the Center for European Reform in London, former Slovak defense official. I wonder if we'd spoken enough about the economic crisis. I mean, we spent the afternoon talking about missions and scenarios and security crises, but not enough about resources. And I wonder if we risk making a dangerous assumption that the budgetary environment we operate in for the future will be sort of like what we are facing now, maybe a little worse. I suspect it will be a lot worse rather than a little worse, as Sasha Vondra warned, and one of the few honorable exceptions who has opened the topic of the resources, as mentioned earlier. The reasons for that are a little too complicated to go into in 2 minutes, particularly since we're running out of time, but they have to do with the staggering levels of debt that governments are taking on, the increasing difficulties of some governments of financing the debt, Latvia is an example here, and the inflexibility of some forms of government expenditures, like the cost of servicing the debt, which leave defense particularly vulnerable. If we're looking at a defense budget crisis, which I suspect we are, there's really only two ways out. One is obviously spending smarter, but really that means dramatically cutting the command structures. That means doing away with the practice of using defense procurement as a job creation program and really collaborating and buying off the shelf, buying abroad. They're politically very difficult. I suspect the solution and the conclusion may be doing less. Two practical points for the strategic concept, because that's the reason we're here today. I hope the strategic concept goes through an equally rigorous examination of resources, as rigorous as the examination of risks and missions. And B, I hope it actually offers a fairly clear priorities, because again, given that there's every chance we may end up doing less than we want, I think it will be important that it ends up producing quite clear priorities on what are some of the things that we might have to drop off the agenda in case the budgetary environment turns out as bad as I think it might be.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Less money means that we're going to have to be even more exact in our triage of missions and how we do them. Ambassador Robert Hunter.
Thank you. This goes to a resource question that we haven't really talked about, which is how NATO does its business. NATO headquarters is underfunded. Its capacity to interact with others is underfunded. There are a lot of complaints out of the military that NATO can't, NATO headquarters can't reach its decisions in a timely way, that in effect the consensus principle may need to be varied. And this may not sound like it's directly related to a strategic concept, but how NATO does its business is clearly going to be part of whether we can bridge some gaps. I noticed, for example, we've got these television cameras here, television screens. I don't think they have them in the NAC room. I don't think I have the capacity to move documents electronically around NATO. There will be when there's a new NATO headquarters, if it ever gets built in the next century sometime. The Allied Command Transformation has already come up with a device called the NATO Strategic Overview. I think it's worth looking at, especially so that the military, when they're in these various missions, including the ones we're hearing about here, and others in these missions, will be able to do the kinds of business that will be based upon modern business principles so that NATO can actually perhaps do more and do it more effectively than it can at the moment.
Thank you. And I apologize now. There are more questions here, but we cannot address them. We cannot take them now because we only have 3 minutes left. So that leaves 1 minute to each of our speakers. In reverse order, please. General Bontejan.
Thank you very much. I try to be extremely brief. Sur les caveats, tout d'abord, les caveats un poison, bien sûr, nous le savons, mais les caveats, c'est aussi la condition pour qu'un pays participe à une opération. Et cette condition, généralement, est imposée par les parlements. Comment agir? La seule manière concrète que nous ayons trouvée, c'est que le commandant d'opération, SACUR pour l'OTAN, intervienne discrètement auprès des contributeurs pour que ces caveats soient petit à petit réduites au minimum possible. Et en général, d'ailleurs, les résultats ne sont pas nuls. Deuxièmement, la double mission permanente de nos forces, c'est-à-dire à la fois combattre et simplement maintenir la paix. Nous sommes déjà soumis à ce régime depuis plusieurs années. Ça se traduit par des équipements qui sont capables de participer à l'une ou l'autre mission, donc des compromis, inévitablement. Et ça se traduit en pratique par des règles d'engagement souples qui permettent, selon le moment, selon la nécessité, de passer d'une attitude bénévole à une attitude de combat. Et je crois que, grosso modo, jusqu'à présent, les forces européennes de l'OTAN ou de l'Union européenne ont démontré leur capacité à passer de l'une à l'autre. En ce qui concerne la réaction rapide, je peux difficilement parler pour la NRF, bien sûr, mais nous avons les mêmes interrogations en ce qui concerne les battle groups de l'Union européenne. Oui, il faut les utiliser un jour ou l'autre, parce que cette permanence, en réalité, limite nos capacités de génération de force. Et petit à petit, la crédibilité de ces capacités de réaction rapide diminue si nous ne les utilisons jamais. Mais précisément, je crois qu'aussi bien à l'OTAN qu'à l'Union européenne, il y a des réflexions très importantes qui sont conduites pour modifier la manière dont ces forces de réaction rapide sont conçues et peuvent être déployées. Sur l'absence d'obligation pour intervenir au profit des autres, je crois que c'est précisément la raison pour laquelle Saint-Malo, en 1998, a offert une possibilité à l'Union européenne d'agir seule au cas où l'OTAN ne souhaitait pas ou ne pouvait pas intervenir. Il reste maintenant à s'assurer que l'OTAN et l'Union européenne, sans les États-Unis, sans l'Amérique du Nord et sans les alliés qui n'appartiennent pas à l'Union européenne, soient capables de faire face aux défis. Je crois que déjà Berlin Plus apporte au moins une réponse partielle en permettant à l'Union européenne de bénéficier des capacités collectives de l'OTAN. Enfin, sur les ressources, je dirais simplement un mot, c'est que, évidemment, nos ressources sont insuffisantes à l'heure actuelle, mais que la seule solution que nous ayons trouvée en pratique, aussi bien à l'OTAN qu'à l'Union européenne, c'est d'essayer en permanence d'avoir le better use of our money. Il n'y a pas d'autre solution.
Thank you. Jan Kopernicki.
I'd just like to pick up on the point about the economic situation.
Can you hold the mic a bit?
Yeah. I'd like to pick up on the point about the economic situation. I think there's a double whammy, if not a triple whammy. I think the consensus is that we're in for a long problem. And B, the suggestion is that there will not be a return to the status quo. And it's probably the second point that's the most difficult one in that. Now, that in turn triggers conversations about focus areas. And I know in certain militaries that excites various branches of the military to suggest their solution is better than others. I think some care in this discussion will have to be taken about what real needs are in this developing world. And I think the third thing which it triggers and links to conversations earlier in the day is the need for the broader alliance beyond NATO itself. We've talked about the relationship with the European Community, and that's evident. But there's also the dependency on energy, and not least from Russia, a very near neighbour, and the importance of developing the alliance with Russia and the warm relations with that country, and perhaps leaving in history not just the Cold War, but the in and out of the refrigerator door war that followed it.
Thank you. Professor Richardson.
Thank you. Four questions to which I'll respond very, very quickly. The first, war of ideas. Yes, emphatically. If NATO declares a goal to counter terrorism, then we'll have to engage in a war of ideas. We've seen the popularity of the NATO ideology through the enlargement. This NATO, I think, has an ideology that has potential to be enormously attractive, but it has to be out there and selling it. And this is an area where we in the West, I think, have allowed ourselves astonishingly to be outplayed by our adversaries and not making this into a war of ideas, because on that ground I'm confident we can win. I wish I could agree with the ambassador that there is a demonstrable direct link between poverty and terrorism. I've been searching for one for many years, and it simply isn't there. Nationalist terrorist groups have emerged invariably in situations in which the nationalist group in particular was relatively better off, whether they're Sikhs, Tamils, Basques, you name it. Jihadi groups, according to the work of Mark Sageman that was alluded to, teams of economists in Princeton have again demonstrated that members of jihadi groups, by and large, belong to above-average socioeconomic conditions. If there were a direct link between poverty and terrorism, we'd see a lot more poverty in the a lot more terrorism in the world and in places in which it doesn't exist. This is not an argument for not doing everything we possibly can to counter poverty, but it is an argument that the social science evidence of a direct link does not as yet exist. Yes, to Fraser Cameron's question, I think there is a narrowing of approaches between the EU and the US. The US, I think, has learned from its own mistakes. One of the tragedies of the past 8 years, I think, is that the US failed to learn from the mistakes of others, has learned from its own mistakes. The result is indeed being a narrowing of approaches. And finally, on whether or not NATO should also include softer security forces, if you will, like policing. My point was not that the military did not have a role in countering terrorism, rather that the military was too blunt an instrument to be relied upon exclusively to counter terrorism. Again, I think if the NATO strategic concept stipulates a goal of countering terrorism, then it will have to be have a multifaceted response that will indeed rely on many facets, including police and intelligence and investment and not just the military.
Thank you very much. Brutal time constraints, great contributions from the floor, from the panel. Let's give them a hand.
Tom, I'd like to thank you. I do apologize for imposing a time limit on you, but I must say you responded magnificently and only took an additional few moments, which you deserve, by the way. It's simply that we have to finish more or less on time because many people have told me that they have flights or trains reserved, and it would not be very good for the NATO budget, frankly, if we had to put everybody up for an extra night in the hotel as a consequence. So thank you indeed. Tom, for moderating the panel. What we're going to do now is, could I ask you please not to leave the room, if you don't mind, because we can do the final changement de décor in just a couple of minutes, even less, and then we can have the three concluding points of the day, which is, first of all, to have a perspective from our Supreme Allied Commander Transformation, then to hear from our rapporteur what he has been able to make of all of this during the day, and then just to have some closing words from the Secretary General. So if anybody has to go out, of course, please, you're free to do so, but if you don't mind just having, as I said earlier, the baseball stand up from your seat leg stretch, we'll change the decor, and then we'll start again immediately, and that will get us back on schedule. So again, dear panelists, many thanks indeed.